Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 101 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. You can listen to us at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and including your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift. Jim West, a previous guest on the show, wrote me a little note about the Stefan Lanka interview. He said it was a great interview, good historicity, and that your interview technique was also good. Thanks, Jim. Have a long interview this week, so let's get right to it. Linda Payne is the president and co-founder of the Election Integrity Project that has the motto, "Every lawfully cast vote accurately counted." In 2009, she co-founded the Santa Clarita Tea Party, and in 2010 helped found the Southern California Liberty Coalition. After she learned about True the Vote, a Texas initiative, she used those ideas to found the Election Integrity Project along with four other people. Welcome to the show, Linda.
Thank you, David, for having me.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you knew, but I'm from Canada, and we have a very different system, and I find the American system fascinating. It has some really good aspects and some kind of crazy aspects, and so hopefully you'll help me understand this a little bit better.
Sure.
So your motto, as I read, is every lawfully cast vote accurately counted, but when we get down to basics, is one person, one vote what you're really aiming for?
Well, absolutely, because the only way we can have a true republic is that the elections are fair and honest and without corruption. One citizen, one vote is really what this is all about, because in a republic, the citizens make the rules of how the republic works. And so in order to vote on those rules, you must be a citizen. So it's really not one person, one vote. It's one citizen, one vote.
Right, but one of the things that fascinates me, America is such a complicated place. I mean, there's citizens in America that don't really get to vote. Like, for example, if you live in Washington, D.C., you can't vote for congressmen. And if you live in Puerto Rico, you're an American citizen, but you don't get to vote for anything except your local governor.
Yeah, those two areas, I agree, are a little more complicated. They function more like territories, and I know there's been effort even recently to make changes in those two areas.
Yeah, there's been a push to get a congressman for Washington, D.C. for a long time, and as far as I know, I thought that they had got one, but then I looked it up recently, and it didn't seem like it actually had happened.
I believe that's because the original concept of Washington, D.C. was not so much representation of a state as it was a location where the Congress met in order to govern. And so I think that's where that breakdown happened. But then as Washington, D.C. has grown, mm-hmm. and so many people live there, it really now, even population-wise, would and should be looked at as a state, in my opinion. That's, mm-hmm. you know, of course, Congress would have to vote on that. But the challenge with Washington, D.C. is it is probably the most, if not one of the most, wealthy areas of the country, and that is because government has become corrupt, and through cronyism that we really are losing our republic in America.
Actually, Washington, D.C., it has a lot of poverty, but I mean, I know there's a lot of rich people there, but they generally live in Virginia or Maryland, right?
Right. It's the county surrounding it, and that is a big issue for us as well, is you have those areas that are extremely poor, and you have citizens in those areas, for instance, wanting to have say-so over their lives in schools.
Right.
They had a program where they could have vouchers and be able to choose private schools, and there was, I believe, a you could get your kids on a list, and it was not everyone got in. The unfortunate thing is that was done away with, and it's hard for me to understand, other than it goes back to cronyism. When you have unions, like the teachers union, that has so much power over those in government, then those in government make decisions based on what the unions can provide for them, which usually is money.
That's a good topic of discussion, but I want to focus on elections because that's a big enough topic to talk about for an hour. So you call your organization Election Integrity Project. How do you define election integrity?
Well, the electoral process is developed to have a set amount of rules in addition to variations of the implementation of the rules. And so it's actually a process in which citizens can have say-so in their government, because that
right.
is what a government is. So to have integrity in the election process, there has to be some kind of oversight that ensures that those who are handling that process are, in fact, ensuring that the election laws are followed, and that those who are attempting to manipulate the system are easily recognized and stopped.
Right. Now, in Canada, for example, elections are run by a supposedly nonpartisan organization. Like the federal government and each province has an election administration, which is barred from, you know, acting in any kind of partisan way. But in America, elections are generally run by the Secretary of State, which is a partisan position. I mean, do you see that as a problem in the American elections?
Well, it's not supposed to be a partisan position. The Secretary of State and the county registrars of voters are supposed to be nonpartisan offices. But what has happened in America is a corruption of that process, because when people end up being elected or appointed to a county registrar position or the Secretary of State position, if they do not have a strong sense of integrity, they can be manipulated or paid off, or they can simply believe that their party has a better idea, and they are willing to allow for corruption in the process that would favor their party.
I mean, a Secretary of State runs for either the Republican or Democratic or a third party, right? I mean, they don't run as an independent, nonpartisan entity. They run as a partisan candidate.
Correct. But when they get into office, their job is then to govern in a nonpartisan way. But that doesn't always happen.
I mean, that's kind of like electing a wolf to be a sheep, and as soon as they get elected, they're going to become a sheep, right?
No, I have to agree with you on that. Once upon a time, we really had a very high standard for integrity, and people would go into office and they take an oath of office to do all kinds of things, including protect and defend that office. So,
right.
If they don't do that,
I mean, I totally agree that the person running the elections should be acting in a nonpartisan way, and it's unfortunate that they get elected in a partisan way. It's hard to make that transition. I think one of your concerns is you said that you want every American citizen to vote, and there's been a lot of discussion about identity cards, things like that. How do you establish citizenship in the United States? Like if somebody was to challenge you, how would you prove to them that you are a citizen?
Well, I have a birth certificate that shows that I was born in the United States.
Right, and I guess the United States is a bit unique in that if you're born in the U.S., even if your parents are not citizens, you automatically become a citizen, right?
Well, that's what's happening now due to the 14th Amendment. Many don't believe that was ever the intention of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment happened after slavery was abolished, and it was to ensure that freed slaves were not considered property because mm-hmm. once upon a time they were. The challenge with the 14th Amendment is it came from political cronyism. I don't remember the date, but it actually came from legislation and an understanding of the Congress as they wanted to make it possible to bring a larger number of people from other countries here and grow the citizenry that way. So, you know, I think it starts with good ideas, and then there are the unintended consequences. The problem became the problem of the people coming here illegally and then having children here, and then the children become citizens, is what was passed was an idea of chain migration. And see, that is where the problem is. Not so much the 14th Amendment, but the agreement by Congress to allow for chain migration. And chain migration never ends. So if someone comes illegally, they have children, from that point, those children can allow for aunts, uncles, grandparents, you name it, on down the line.
The 14th Amendment says that those children are citizens. But let's say that you moved to the United States and you later became a citizen. So how would you prove your citizenship in that? Do you get a card of some kind if you become an American citizen?
Yes, you have to go through classes. You have to learn about the American history and the mm-hmm. American concept of government. And once you have passed, you have to learn English and understand it and be able to take the classes in English. So that's being kind of ignored. And so when you complete the class, then you go through a swearing-in process. And it's during that time where they take the oath become American citizens, follow the laws, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so at that point, they have a documentation that shows that they have become a naturalized citizen.
Right. Another problem with voting is there's a lot of, they talk about purging the rolls, which relies on your identity, but there's lots of reports of people with relatively common name being purged because there's a record in two adjacent states, but it's actually two different people. How do you establish a unique identity on the U.S. voting rolls? I mean, does the Social Security number get used, or is it just your name and address?
No, there's actually many identifiers that are used to identify the voter. Our organization does not actually have access to all of those identifiers, and so for us, when we do our research, we provide a report to the registrar to let them know that we have flagged potential duplicated voters or voters registered in more than one county or more than one state. And then it's up to the registrars to take that information and go deeper. But what they look at is the name of the person, the birth date, the address, and the address where you register has to be what is considered your domicile. It's where you live, where you lay your head.
So if you have a P.O. box, you can't use that as your as your domicile.
Correct. It must be where you lay your head, where you live. You can have material sent to a post office box, your bulk bat ballot, and that kind of thing, but you can only register at your domicile. They look at your birth date, your Social Security, your driver's license. Election Integrity Project does not have access to driver's license and social. They also look at your birth certificate. When you go to get a driver's license in a new state, they ask to see your birth certificate. So there are some states that are now saying, no, we don't really care about that. You don't have to show that. So there's a lot of debate across America about eliminating some kind of identifier that shows that you are, in fact, a citizen. But the birth certificate is one of those documents that would do that.
And how many documented cases of non-citizens voting in American elections are there?
There are in other states who have more access to records when there are non-citizens. In my state, there is not a database of non-citizens. In my state, they don't ask those questions. They're usually in the registration process they ask place of birth. And so there's now talk about, well, let's just eliminate asking for the place of birth. The challenge that's happening.
But I mean, if I came from Mexico and I was in California, I could just say Los Angeles, right? Like that.
You know, you could lie, but you'd have to fill out. And here's where the problem is: if you came from Mexico or any other state, any other country, I mean, and you were applying for a driver's license.
Right.
At the point of applying for a driver's license, current law, and it's federal law, requires that the DMV must give you the opportunity to register and vote. And so if you're not a citizen, a person with integrity would say, oh, I'm not a citizen, I can't vote here.
Right.
Or a person who understands, see, sometimes they don't really understand the documents because their language is limited or they don't speak English at all.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand the document. So when they fill out the application to register to vote, that's where they answer those questions. Are you a U.S. citizen?
Right.
Now, our challenge in our application process is the applications have a little section where you sign and they say you're declaring that, yes, I am 18 years of age, I am a U.S. citizen, and I live in the county in which I'm registering.
Right.
And so when you sign that, you're signing under penalty of perjury that you are not lying.
Right.
The problem is, if you don't understand English, you don't understand what you signed.
Right. But then you probably also wouldn't go out and vote, right? If you didn't know what you signed, you probably wouldn't even realize that you had the right to vote.
Well, not necessarily.
I guess my question is, how much documented evidence is there that there are, you know, any significant number of non-citizens voting because they somehow managed to get registered?
Well, again, it will depend on the state. If the state allows for oversight groups to be able to identify that this person was, in fact, not a citizen, for instance, if they register to vote, then they also end up getting on the jury pool. And so we have documentation of people receiving a summons to work as a jurist, and they will say, oh, I can't do that because I'm not a citizen. We also have some states that allow people to come in with cameras and interview people where they are concerned that they might not be citizens, and they'll knock on the door and ask them, it shows here that you registered to vote and you're not a citizen. And we've actually got some video on that where the person will say, well, I don't know how I got on there. Because we do know that there are people on the rolls who may not even know they're on the voter rolls because they didn't really understand what they were signing. And here's what we see. We see a manipulation of the process, not so much tens of thousands of non-citizens who are attempting to manipulate the system.
Mm-hmm.
My personal opinion is there is more of a manipulation happening. For instance, let's look at California. Our National Voter Registration Act manual includes instructions for the registrars on how to handle applications that come in where the question of citizenship is not answered. There's a specific question on the application, are you
right.
a U.S. citizen? If they don't check that box, the instructions in the manual tell the registrar, send a postcard to the person, let them know they forgot to check the box, ask them to check it. And then they give instructions on what to do with response. If they check the box and send it back, then you put them on the voter rolls. If they don't check the box, then one instruction says, then they don't go on the voter rolls. And then the very next instruction says, well, if they don't send it back, but they sign the application, then go ahead and put them on the voter rolls because they declared they were U.S. citizens.
I mean, I understand it's a problem that there are people on the voter rolls who aren't citizens, but what you've described is that most of those people aren't even aware they're on the rolls, and it's probably some kind of clerical error or misunderstanding. But is there documented evidence that some of these people are voting, either intentionally or maybe not without realizing that they're not supposed to be voting?
Well, in California, we would not be able to prove that because we are limited. We can look at numbers. We can tell you how the process works, and it's the process that is causing concern that illegitimate voters are voting because the process does not protect against it. Other states actually can prove it because their system is different than California. They can actually approach voters. They can see data that indicates that a person is not a U.S. citizen. But California, we are very limited. So instead, what we look at is evidence that causes red flags or concern,
mm-hmm.
and then we bring that to the attention of registrars. And for instance, this is what we see in California that is causing us alarm here. We have observed and identified a pattern in which there are large numbers of vote-by-mail ballots being sent to a post office box. Now, a post office box usually represents one address, one family, one
right.
home. And so let's say you've got adult kids living there, and you've got two parents and three adult kids still living at home. So you might have five vote-by-mails going to a post office box.
Right.
But you definitely would not have 20 or 12 or 50 or 100. So when we have the managers or owners of mail centers, post office box stores, asking our representatives, what do we do with all these voting materials that are coming to this box? Or at the end of an election in 2014, we had two different stores. One had approximately 50 ballots in his box, and he didn't want to commit mail fraud, so he didn't know what to do with that. He said, what do I do with these 50 vote-by-mail ballots? Another
right.
had almost 100. So what we do is we dig in and we say, well, how is it possible that 50 to 100 voter registrations had the same P.O. box to have their materials sent to? And how could that happen?
Right.
So when we pair it back, we begin to see that many of those are duplicated voter registrations. And so, for instance, I would see my name, Linda Payne. Well, I don't use a middle initial, but the duplicated voter registration includes a middle initial, Linda X. Payne. And then I would see my domicile, and the domicile is almost exactly correct because you cannot register without a domicile. But then the birth date is ever so slightly adjusted. So the month might be off by a few, or the year
right.
by a few.
So you're saying that this, have you proven that this is fraud and not some, reasonable excuse?
We've given names to the DA, yep. We can tell you who's doing it. Once we can show duplication, we have one gentleman in Riverside County was duplicated 7 times. So once we show that there is, in fact, duplication, and the way we find that is when you register to vote, the voter application has an affidavit number in the top left-hand
mm-hmm.
corner.
Mm-hmm.
And the rule for people who are doing registration drives is they have to turn in the completed registrations within 3 days of having checked them out. So when we start to see duplications, then we open up the column. And by the way, when we do our work, we close the columns for the party affiliation. We don't look at that. We're looking for the other identifiers. But when we see duplications, then we go ahead and bring up the affidavit numbers. And there it is. You will see affidavit numbers sequentially, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way down. And you'll see that these applications were turned in within 3 days.
That would obviously sound like fraud, but how many of these cases are there, and why are those people not in jail? Because, that's pretty clear evidence of fraud.
Well, it's political.
Fraud.
Yep, it's political. When we see that as a citizen organization, we then have the right to ask for a copy of those voter registration affidavits.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where we can actually see the name of the person
right.
who duplicated. We can see the organization that they were affiliated with. And so then what we do is we turn that report into the registrar. We ask them to provide that information to the DA in their county. And what we're finding is the DAs do nothing. That's why you don't see all kinds of cases and media, because voter fraud is what we consider the perfect crime for several reasons. But one is the lack of willingness of the DAs to take action. And the reason they don't take action, we believe, we've never had a DA tell us this, but we believe it's not politically correct, number one. And number two, if they're going to run for office, they're going to run for a judge, they've got political aspirations, well, to go after someone who committed voter fraud is not politically correct. And the media could really go after them, call them names.
How many of these cases have you turned up?
We just turned 25 names into Riverside County. We've been at this 6 years now, and we turn in names every time we see them. We have not yet seen a DA take action. Now, the interesting thing is we did have one DA say if we could begin to turn this information in, not so much under voter fraud, which it is, but if we could somehow turn it in as identity theft, well, then there's going to be money to prosecute. So I do think that part of the issue is who's going to pay for prosecution? Who's going to bring the charges forward? Well, the registrars of voters are broke. We're a citizen organization. We can't file legal action against every name we provided to them. So that gave me a little bit of a clue that perhaps some of it is politics, but some of it is money.
I could see that if you had California is largely, I think a lot of parts of California are largely Democrat, but I guess there's other parts of the Republican. If you wanted to, you know, ensure that you stayed in power, you could create several thousands of these duplicates. But I mean, the risk is that some people eventually, it's going to rise to the point where some people are going to go to jail for a long time. And you know, you're describing, you know, a relatively small number that wouldn't have actually changed the outcome of any elections unless they were really close. So it seems like an awfully dangerous thing to do, but to accomplish nothing, really. Like if you added 25 extra voters to a congressional district, which I believe has about 1 million people in it, it's not likely to overturn the election, is it?
Well, if you just took that one step of doing voter registration fraud, no, it would not. It is the next part of the process that changes the outcome of elections. So then let's go to the next step. So
okay.
Someone has been able to duplicate, you know, citizen voters, get non-citizens on the voter rolls, knowingly or not, whatever. But we now have bloated voter rolls. So two things happen with the bloated voter rolls. And we have identified in 2012 hundreds of thousands of duplicated voter registrations across the state. So that's not a small number. Hundreds of thousands creates a narrative. It creates a narrative that, look at, we have one party that are registering to vote 2-1. Well, if those increased registrations are fraudulent registrations, the public doesn't know they're fraudulent.
Well, many of them could be completely innocent. Like if you move from one county to another, you may end up with a duplicate, right? Move to from a state to another.
Absolutely. So not all of them are fraudulent. Yes, thank you for bringing that up. Yes, so much does happen. It's a wide range of issues, and it's because our system is not secure, it's easy to manipulate, and because citizens are no longer educated about the election process, they actually really don't understand the process and how it works, and there's no good way that we know of right now in which the Secretary of State and the registrars are reaching into the citizens of their county or of all people, citizens and non-citizens, helping them understand the election process. So absolutely right. And we have seen that as I've met and spoke with groups across the state. We see people in one county who have a home. They move to another county, but to keep the home, they rent it out. But because the registrars have not cleaned up their voter rolls, then that person stays on the voter rolls. And the interesting thing is they still get the voter material, but they get it at the house they move to in the other county. That's the breakdown.
Well, they might get it twice, I guess. But I mean, you're describing how the voter rolls are padded with, you know, duplicates. So there's more people in the rolls than should be there. But I don't understand. You know, if somebody's voting in one county and they're still registered somewhere else, I mean, unless they actually activate both votes,
they do. They tell me they do. They tell me they do because they didn't realize they couldn't. their misunderstanding is that if you've got someone who lived in Orange County, for instance, had a home, moved, they're renting it out, bought a home in L.A. County, so they ended up getting the registration, the voting material from Orange County and L.A. County. And their belief was, before we met with them, that, well, I own property in both counties, so that's why the registrar sent it to me. Because why would the registrar send it to me if they didn't intend for me to vote?
Well, I guess it depends on the kind of election. Like, if it was civic politics, I guess it wouldn't really be a big deal. I mean, obviously, if it was state or federal, it would be a big deal if you voted twice.
Well, actually, it would be a big deal because each community has people that they elect to govern them in their own community. Water district, city council members, mayors.
Right.
So, and we know some people will look at that and say, oh, you know, I don't live there, I'm not going to vote. But we also know from people telling me they think that they have the right to vote in the county in which their home is, where they're renting it out, because they're property owners.
I understand that that's wrong, but if you lived in two different, like say you spent half the year in Arizona and half the year in Washington State, you know, you might vote for mayor in both places. Would that be a big problem?
That would be illegal. You have to choose a state.
Okay. Are you saying... I mean, I guess I'm not seeing that this is actually resulting in a lot of fraud. You have hundreds of thousands of people, but you're not saying that hundreds of thousands are voting twice.
It's not so much voting twice. So then now let me go to the next stage.
Mm-hmm.
And now where the real problem happens is in the polls. That's truly where the manipulation takes place. It's in our provisional ballot system. So if you've got, starting off with bloated voter rolls, people who either don't exist, they've passed away, they're duplicated, or they're registered in more than one county. So for many reasons, you've got a bloated list. And then on the list, they're registered at a domicile somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes election day, the people registered in a district will go to polling locations in that district, and they will be listed in two places. There's a street index that hangs near the door. It can hang outside or inside,
right,
but more often it hangs outside. So on that street index is a name, an address, a phone number, and a party affiliation.
Right.
And then the inside, where the clerks work, you have a list there where they check people in.
Right.
And our laws here in California, the check-in procedure is supposed to protect against voter impersonation.
Mm-hmm.
But because our state does not require that law actually be followed, they allow for a very simple procedure where someone can come in to check in and simply have in their hand a piece of paper, a 3x5 card, a sample ballot, whatever they have. All they have to do is have something with a name and an address on it. They can hand it to the clerk and go through the check-in process. Now, we have identified and then turned in many reports about this in counties across our state.
So why, explain to me why they're not on the voter's roll at all?
They're taking someone else's name, and we have seen where they come to that street index, and they write down names and addresses of voters. Now, those who are really in the manipulation part of it, who have access to the voter rolls, they can actually see voter history. So when they start to see voters that have a history of not voting very often, they'll start with those names because that person will never know that someone voted in their place.
And is the history of voting, do you get access to somebody's history of voting?
Yeah, we have the voter history. So we can see that. We can clearly see how, you know, who votes often and who rarely votes. We can see who's considered active. In order to be considered an active voter, you have to have voted in the previous two.
So you're saying that somebody can come to a polling station, read the list outside, and, you know, maybe they have looked at the voters list ahead and they know that Joe Blow at this street address hasn't voted for 10 years. Maybe Joe Blow's dead, so they write it on a piece of paper and walk in and say, I'm Joe Blow, I want to vote?
Right, or they can pick it up from the mailbox door because they know that that's a person who doesn't exist, that was a duplicated person, so then they can simply take their vote by mail that they picked up from the post office box and go to a polling location, drop it off, or they can turn it in and get a regular ballot. So there's lots of ways that the system can be manipulated because the laws don't protect against it.
Well, I can see that this could be done, but again, I mean, this is a pretty dangerous thing to be doing if you get caught doing this.
Not really. It is the perfect crime. It's not dangerous. And here's why. So we have seen, we have identified polling location where in the morning you have a number of people, 5 to 10 people will come to the polls and pull down that street index, split it apart, and sit down right there and start writing down names and numbers, or they'll get a picture of it, they can't pull it. They're not allowed actually legally to pull it down, tear it apart, and do that. But lack of training results in the inspectors not realizing they're not allowed to do that. So then anyway, that's what they'll do is pull it down. Then we'll see the pattern of mid-afternoon, maybe 4 o'clock-ish, 4 to 5. You'll see all kinds of people coming in with simply a piece of paper, 3x5 card, and walk up to the clerk. And there's two ways to do it. You go to the check-in clerk, and they'll look on the list, and they'll say, oh, okay, there you are, Linda Payne. And so instead of me actually having my name is Linda Payne,
right.
They just look at the paper, check it off. They hand the paper to the next clerk. So instead of me having to say, I live at 23134, they simply check it off. Then I go to the third station. The third station is supposed to be a blank space so that I have to write down my address. Because if I know my address, I'm going to be able to write it down.
Right.
If I'm trying to impersonate you, I'm going to have to think about it. I'm going to say, give me that paper back. But what's happening is the counties are now pre-printing that, even though the law says they're supposed to leave it open. But since it's pre-printed, I can come in, not speak English, not know how to say a very complicated name, simply walk and hand that paper to the clerk. They simply go through the checkout process, and I've never said a word. Then I get to the point where I sign the book. So then I sign the book. Now, here's the thing. That book is never checked against anyone. But even if it was, they don't know who I am. I never gave them my real name.
Right, but by signing, you've just committed a major fraud, and if you got
Absolutely.
Caught doing this, so in order to get one vote illegally, you have to commit a major fraud which could send you to jail for years.
It can send you to jail, and everyone knows that. Nobody will catch you, and we've proven this. In California, we proved it, because we see it in busloads. People come in busloads and do this. So it's not just one and two here and there.
But
let me finish out.
So
when you go through and you check in, you get the ballot, you go and vote, you come back and you put the ballot in the box. There is nothing on that ballot that identifies the person who voted. It's a private ballot. So what we do, we get calls all over the state where people say, I went in to vote and I was told I already voted and I did not vote. And that signature is not my signature. So now we know that that voter was impersonated. However, nobody knows who the real person is who impersonated them, because that person's DNA can't be matched against anything. Their signature can't be matched because they don't even know who the person's real identity is. So nobody is afraid of doing this. It is the perfect crime.
I mean, I don't know if it's the perfect. To me, the perfect crime is having a voting machine which changes the results after people vote, because that's completely
even more perfect. Yes,
even more perfect. But
I agree.
But I mean, how many people these paper systems are pretty good at detecting duplicate voting because they cross your name off, right? So if somebody does vote for you, say early in the day, and you come in and you can't vote because supposedly you already did.
It's not that you can't vote. You now must vote with what is called a provisional ballot.
Right.
So nobody's ever turned away. In fact, California voted 40% of all provisional ballots nationwide in 2012.
And how many provincial ballots actually get counted? Actually get
well, L.A. County says that 90%, that they count 90% of the provisional ballots.
Hmm. One critic of the electoral system, Jeremy Scahill, called it a placebo ballot because he said they usually don't get counted. And it just makes you feel good because you filled in a ballot. But in actual fact...
Some counties that is true. And the ones that really don't get counted, what I would agree is a placebo ballot is often if they vote out of county.
Right.
They really are being disenfranchised because they're being told they can vote out of county. But in reality, the county cannot identify it and mail it to the correct county in time for it to be counted. So, yeah, I agree, that is a placebo. The ones that are not placebos in our system are like in L.A. County where they told us they count 90%. And so, and the problem now, again, with the 90%, let's go back to the system where I'm going to impersonate a voter. The other way that the impersonation takes place is that the person who has taken someone's name and address, someone's identity, mm-hmm. they don't go to the location where the person's name was actually hanging on that street index. They go to a different location. And we've identified and documented this as well. So what happens there is they go into the check-in, hand them that piece of paper or 3x5 card or whatever they have, and they see that their name is not on the list. So they send them to the table where they're going to vote with a provisional ballot. And what that means is each county has an envelope that is very much like a vote-by-mail envelope.
Right.
So they sit with the clerk and they fill out the envelope where they live, et cetera, et cetera. So they've got that piece of paper with the information on it, and they simply fill it out, name, address, you know, phone number, their party affiliation, and they sign it. And then they get a ballot, and that ballot's the same ballot that everybody else gets because the ballots all look alike. They don't have.
But it is a provisional ballot, right?
But it's, the ballot itself is what's confusing to people is they think that the provisional ballot looks different than the other ballot.
It's just a regular ballot, but it's the status of the ballot is provisional, so it gets handled differently.
Correct.
But you just said that normally those don't get counted if it's out of county, so they've gone to all of these steps and they've cast a vote that doesn't get counted.
Well, most of them happen in county, so the only ones that are placebo is if they're out of county. Most happen in county. So then the person goes to vote, they come back, they put the ballot in the provisional envelope, and then, of course, it goes to the registrar's office and it's processed. Now, what we have observed in the ballot processing system is that the people who are there to process ballots really have no training in true signature verification. They just say match them as best you can. And we have identified ballots on the screen. They'll have the voter affidavit on the screen, sometimes 4 to 6 at a time. And then they'll bring those vote by mail and provisional ballot at this stage of the game are processed the same way. They're looking for the signature match. And we have identified signatures that are absolutely opposite. There's nothing alike. The slants are opposite. It's not like someone had Parkinson's and now it's a squiggly.
Right.
They are absolutely opposite. But they are accepted, bing, because they have like 3 seconds to quickly review these signatures, 3 to 5 seconds. And they're looking as fast as they can. And California's mandate says to the person who's doing the signature verification that if they are to err, they must err on the side of the voter.
Right.
So that is a broad spectrum.
So are you, I guess I want to get to the point, are you saying that if I go and vote in my correct place, you know, I'm perfectly legitimate, I go and vote in my correct place, somebody votes in another polling station in the same county, would they count both of those votes? Like, surely the same voter can't have voted twice. That would be obviously, wouldn't that be an obvious duplicate vote and that would cause an investigation?
Well, we would think so, but it appears that nobody is looking at that because the problem is, in order, by the time they find out that there were 2 Linda Paynes who voted, they've had to process tens of thousands, some millions in L.A. County,
right.
1.4 million ballots of all kinds, and they're getting through as fast as they can. Everyone wants to call the race, so they call the race, and to actually be able to find that duplicate, They have to do what we do. They have to go through and meticulously look line by line, voter histories, who voted, who. That's when they would find it. But by that time, the races are already called.
Yeah, but it's not too late to send somebody to jail who's been pulling this stunt off.
There's not the will to do it. There is not the will to do it.
In your 2012 report, you documented 1,740 incidents throughout the state of California, right?
Right.
And most of those, in many of those cases, people were actually denied the right to vote. They had to fill out a provisional ballot, things like that. And in many cases, there were problems with poor training and people not quite following procedures. But of those 1,740 incidents, I didn't go through them all individually, but I didn't see any of them that resulted in somebody voting twice.
Well, we didn't. That wouldn't have been in that report. We give much more in-depth reports to the county registrars themselves because our goal has always been correct the system. We realize as a citizen oversight group, we have no power over prosecution. We're not attorneys. We're not law enforcement. We're not in positions of authority like the registrar is. So our job is research, creating what we call critical intelligence, critical intel, critical information that we believe would help the registrar to look deeper. And that's our motivation. We don't do a lot of public shaming of the registrars because we do believe that by and large, most of the issues come from poor policies, poor procedures, lack of doing good data research. We know at least one county that changed the way they were reviewing their data because we provided them a report that showed, I don't remember the number, but it showed them the number of here's what we found in your data, and it resulted in 12% of their people on their voter rolls as being duplicated or deceased, and they were sending out materials to those 12%. So in our report, we showed them, if you clean up your voter rolls, you will save money because you're sending materials to people who are dead or don't exist.
It would certainly make sense, but managing these big databases is always an issue, and no matter what database you have, there's always problems, so many different sources of information.
But if they know about it, and this is what this one county did, they didn't believe it was right. They asked for a meeting. We met with them. By the time we met with them, they told us that it turned out they had a third party who was running their data. They met with that third party, and turned out the third party had a glitch in their system, and the third party was missing all the items that we provided. When they fixed that glitch, they came up with the same number we came up with, and when they ran their data following the way we do multiple queries of looking for duplications rather than just one straight across exact match, we look for multiple variations. And when they did that, they came up with our exact number. And so they changed the way that they ran their data. And that's our hope, is let us provide you with critical information that might help you, you know, find those duplicates or deceased that are on the
roll. Right. There was a case in Wisconsin where there was a voter law passed for more stringent ID on the basis that voter impersonation was a problem, but the judge wrote, the evidence at trial established that virtually no voter impersonation occurs in Wisconsin. The defendants could not point to a single instance of known voter impersonation occurring in Wisconsin at any time in the recent past, which is a pretty strong statement. You're saying that it can happen, but there's been no prosecutions of this in California recently, of voter impersonation?
Exactly, because it is the perfect crime. Who are you going to prosecute? If I came in and impersonated Jane Doe and went through that process that I explained earlier, and Jane Doe came in to vote after me and said, oh my goodness, I didn't vote, that wasn't me, she would still get a provisional ballot. No one would ever catch me because they don't have my true identity. They don't, if they wanted to check that book, which they don't, if they wanted to check that, whose signature would they match it against? They don't have my true identity.
I think they would get caught. Like, actually, here in my city in Calgary, there was a rare case of voter impersonation, and somebody had a bunch of mail-in ballots sent to a P.O. box. And I think they were actually the husband of the candidate or something like that. So they were going to obviously vote for, everybody knew which candidate they were going to vote for. And I think that person went to jail. They certainly were prosecuted. Maybe they only got a fine or something. But it was actually pretty easy to detect that. So
can I ask you how they detected it?
Well, just from the large number of votes going to a single P.O. box. A large number of ballots obviously was a red flag, right? Like, why would there be so many? And I don't know where they got the names from, but they may have also been able to figure out that these are people who are dead or didn't vote and haven't yet been removed off the voters' rolls. But it seems like you're saying that this could happen, but until there's some prosecutions, there's not actually proof it has happened.
And there's our problem. There we are between a rock and a hard place. We are showing that it can and is, in fact, happening. We have documented and in fact, turned all that documentation into a civil rights hearing here in California on August 28, 2015. The problem is we have documented the procedure. We have documented how it happens. We've documented that nothing is being done about it. We had citizens come from all over the state to testify about what's happened to them and what they're seeing, but there is reluctance to prosecute in every state, in every county here in California, and without prosecution, there is no motivation for people to not manipulate the system.
But without prosecution, there's really no proof that it's actually happening. Like, a lot of this could be clerical errors, like the clerk writes over the wrong person, and so then, you know, somebody comes and it says you've already voted, but it might just be a clerical error.
Well, it's happening in too great a number for it to simply be clerical. The pattern that caused us to start to look into this is when we began to see candidates who were running a race, and at the end of election day, they were 9 points ahead. But by the time they finished counting vote by mail and provisional ballots, they were 9 points behind. It was a very interesting pattern that said, how is it that it's so close to the same number they're ahead when they close the race and they lose by the same number? We've also seen people where the polls indicate that their candidate is going to win by a landslide, by huge numbers. And by the time you close the polls, he lost by just as much.
But that could easily be like voter machine fraud, which is a huge problem, right? If there's somebody's installed malware into a voting machine, it could just say, well, whoever, you know, no matter what the votes are, we're always going to make sure that our guy comes out a few votes ahead.
Right. It could be that. But here's the example where we absolutely know that the manipulation at the polls is in fact happening. And this was a race in Central Valley in 2013. Mm-hmm. Where we ran the data for the four counties involved, provided that information to the county registrars, letting them know that we're seeing some problems in their voter rolls. They might want to watch carefully the vote-by-mail ballots coming in, et cetera, et cetera. We gave the information to the candidates, to the parties, and we tried to give that information to everybody involved in that special election. And then we had our team out there observing and documenting what was happening in the polls. It is in that race that we connected that dot of people pulling names and addresses from street indexes and then flooding and the polls between 5 and 6. And what I mean by flooding, they come in such large numbers, there's lines, and so the clerks are just trying to get the job done and quickly going through, give me the name, move them through. And we told them this candidate, one particular candidate that was favored by everyone in those counties, just about favored to win in big numbers, and people were cheering, he won on election day, he won by X number of points, I don't remember anymore. And we kept saying, wait till they count the provisionals. Sure enough, by the time they finished counting the provisionals, he lost.
And so you're saying those provisionals?
Well, they ran a rerun. That was what would be the primary. So then they did the runoff again. And during the runoff, those counties took very seriously what we said. And one particular county actually put table signs on the tables in her county, voter must speak name and address audibly. And our observers were out there, and we saw people coming to the polls, come to the clerk, see the sign, turn around, and walk away. And the provisional ballot count for that particular county went down multiple points. And I don't have the number off the top of my head. I can look it up for you, but multiple points. Across the other counties, the same thing. There was more of an effort to make sure that the voter coming into the poll was, in fact, the voter. We don't have voter ID here, so the only way they can protect the voter from being impersonated is the check-in procedure. And we saw the provisional ballot drop. We also saw the harvesting of vote by mail drop because, again, this one county did a phenomenal job with her own public service announcement alerting the people that they cannot give their, they must not give their vote by mail ballot to someone who comes to the door that says, let me help you with that, I'll take your vote by mail.
But, you know, if you change the rules, you could discourage, you know, if somebody has to speak their name and they don't speak very good English, then they might be discouraged just because
they're
embarrassed.
They would know how to say their name no matter how complicated it is. And, in fact, that is the best protection for them. If you've got a last name, I don't know, Russian or Pakistani or whatever, mm-hmm. if you've got a very complicated last name that and you're a naturalized citizen and an American-born citizen, they probably would not be able to pronounce that name. That is the best protection for that person coming
but
in.
But why wouldn't
That name will roll right off their tongue.
All right. Why wouldn't I pick up a name off the rolls? You know, Joe Smith. I know Joe Smith hasn't voted for 8 years. So then when it comes my turn, I just say Joe Smith. Like, well, I don't understand why speaking the name is such a big deal.
Well, Joe Smith would be an easy one, but most people's names are not quite so simple. So that's what makes this able to happen in large numbers. America now, we have people from so many countries
right.
that, you know, Joe Smith is... You know,
there's not too many Joe Smiths. Well, I understand, but if I'm going to do voter fraud, I'm going to pick an easy name, somebody who hasn't voted for a long time. I mean, even this Hispanic name, a lot of those are easy. Jose Sanchez, right? Like, it's not very...
Yeah, and but if you're American and you don't have an accent and you say Jose Sanchez and it sounds English-sounding, then that's going to tell the clerk, really? I mean, they're going to ask... And it's not just the name. See, the person who's... If I'm going to impersonate you, I better have memorized your name, your address. I better be able to just write it like I live there. But those who are impersonating in great numbers, we identified two college students in L.A. County. We followed them, going poll to poll. They go to the street index, write down a name, go in, come out, laughing, giggling, get
and
in so, the next one.
So what you're saying is there's this, you know, you got people who are going poll to poll, so this is like massive election fraud. It could send them to jail for, I don't know, 5, 10, 20 years, and nobody wants to do anything about it.
Only if they got caught. See, you're not afraid if you won't get caught. You're not. It's just there's nothing to worry about if you know you can't get caught.
Yeah. Well, anyway, this is pretty interesting, and we've run out of time. We're almost at an hour now. This is longer than I wanted to go. It's really interesting learning more about the internal workings of the election system and what some of your concerns are. So I thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, David. I appreciate being on.
Okay. I'll send you a link to the show when it's up next week.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Good questions. I think you asked the questions that everybody's asking. How is it possible?
Yes. Okay. Thanks, Linda, and goodbye.
Okay. Thanks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 101 of The Infectious Myth.